I want to welcome everybody on the Spearman app. I'm speaking right now with Donald Earl Collins, Associate Professor of History with the University of Maryland University College, and a freelancer whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, Al Jazeera, Huffington Post, and The Guardian. He joins us to talk today about his recent piece for Al Jazeera, The West's Obsession with Itself. Thanks so much for joining us, Donald.
Thank you for having me, Matthew.
So to begin, you note how the right-wing nationalist populism we've seen arise in the United States from the 2008 financial crisis, if not, you know, before that, echoes that of far less extreme voices who see even implicitly the West as the pinnacle of all that humanity has achieved. And anybody who's a very serious, you know, student of history or professor such as yourself knows that that's just completely bogus. But tell us a little bit about those less extreme voices and how we might identify this rhetoric in a less Western egocentric future.
The less extreme voices, there's a lot of variation. The fact is that when you talk about Western civ, when you're talking about it from the standpoint of teaching, or whether you're talking about it in terms of the idea of the West, or even if you're talking about it in the terms of tangible benefits for the West, the less extreme voices tend to be ones that haven't really thought about whether the West has had any real negative impact on the world as a whole, as such. So that's who you're talking about when you're talking about less extreme voices, maybe center right, maybe centrist voices. There's still a tendency,
even among those folks that have not really thought through, well, what do we mean by Western civilization? How much of its development historically has been good for most people? How did it become dominant? How has it remained dominant over the last century or so, you know, a couple of centuries, really? And where are we going, moving ahead with the issues that we face as a globe? Everything from climate change to international terrorism to nuclear proliferation, and to, of course, the big issue that we're facing these days in terms of globalization and migration. How are we dealing with all of those as a globe? And how does that view of the West as being the pinnacle and end-all be-all, that's everything that's positive in the world, impact the way we look at these things? And generally speaking, we don't look at them in very positive terms. And in general, we look at things like migration as possibly a threat, sort of like World War Z, mm-hmm. In which these migrants from these other countries, the third world, the global South, the developing world, somehow will change societies and transform them and end Western civilization ultimately as we know it. Or even if it doesn't end Western civilization, it will transform Western civilization in a way that people who are comfortable with the narrative of the Western civilization is always positive won't like. So, I mean, those are the kinds of things you're talking about with less extreme voices, but it's all sort of the same thing, whether you're talking about it in terms of culture or biology and so on, is the idea that the world is going to inundate Western culture and transform it in a way that people who have been the beneficiaries of Western culture, mainly Western Europe, the United States, Canada, and other industrialized nations, will not like.
Right, right. And would you even qualify rhetoric as, you know, seemingly benign as you know, former President Barack Obama's insistence on American exceptionalism in this category? Or would that be an exception? Do you find that, you know, if David Brooks qualifies, would that qualify? In your view?
I think I don't think that either of them are particularly benign for this reason. Because it excuses ultimately the rest of us from really taking a deep dive into what is Western civilization, what's Western culture, what's been good about it, what's been great about it, what's been not so good about it. When you say American exceptionalism, for instance, when you're talking about Barack Obama or the originator truly of this term, and this is one area where ironically me and 45 might agree with, which is, you know, Sidney Blumenthal via Bill and Hillary Clinton. The whole idea of American exceptionalism is that this nation for however long it's been around, or the idea of this nation, is on the pedestal. That they're, you know, because of its democratic institutions, because of these ideals of equality and freedom and egalitarianism and liberty, all these things, that somehow this sets the United States apart from the rest of the world, both historically and in real terms, you know, in every way you can, in any tangible way you can possibly think about it. When the reality is that the U.S. is not so far removed politically, not so far removed in terms of its own inequalities, whether it's racial or gender or sexual orientation or ultimately economic inequality, that when you use a term like American exceptionalism, you get the gloss over all of that. You get the kind of say, you know, that's we've had these problems, but ultimately we're doing better than, say, not only the rest of the world, but even the rest of the West, even Western Europe itself, because Western Europe has faced all of these problems and started world wars and so on and so forth. So I think even terms like that, even as benign as those terms sound on their face, can also be a detriment in terms of trying to understand what Western culture, Western civilization, Western culture is, and ultimately what it's done.
Indeed. And as someone who teaches, you know, history for a living in higher education, I'm wondering if you can give us, you know, just even your personal take on how you've seen, you know, Western bias, even in our even in higher education. I know you talk a lot about, you know, what's going on in high schools right now, and I want to get there. But do you see this even prevalent in you know, the post-Howard Zinn, you know, higher education, that there's still this lingering bias at all? Or do you think that, you know, higher education over the last 50 years has done well to address this?
It hasn't. I mean, that's the short answer.
Sure.
On the one hand, I think that, you know, there are definitely enough courses in most of our four-year institutions where you can get a good slice of different interpretations of U.S. history, European history, world history, etc., that will give you an exposure to the good, the bad, the not so good, and even ugly of these different cultures and civilizations, and try to understand that some of this good, bad, and ugly is the reason why we're here, the reason why our societies are the way they are, for better and for worse. On the other hand, particularly with course like a survey level course or introductory level course like, say, world history, there is this tendency to really just sort of give people a smorgasbord, a sort of, you know, a set of, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, like mini, you know, there's a little, you know, let's have a pate of sub-Saharan Africa here, or a crudité of, you know, say Indian history and Chinese history there. And so you're just getting a hodgepodge of little bit here, little bit there, without really addressing ultimately not just the rise of Western civilization, how great it is, but how it's been detrimental in some ways to the growth of other cultures and civilizations simultaneously. So it's a mixed bag. There's a lot that historians have been able to do around this, and there's a lot that we just simply have not been able to address, partly because of the contours and nature of courses, and partly because the nature of higher education itself has actually changed the last 30 years to focus, in some respects, less on these lower level courses.
I mean, I think it's an entirely uncontroversial statement to make that, you know, many aspects of higher education over the last few years have been politicized. But as you know, you know, that we find this, you know, getting in even into high school curricula, just with, you know, places, as you write about extensively in the piece, school boards wanting a more U.S. centric, and not just U.S. centric, but U.S. positive, you know, application of how history is taught, even at the AP level, you know, a whitewashing, if you will. which I think is a very, very fair charge. But with all this, and I mean, a lot of these stories date back even to about a half decade ago. So we're seeing these kids, you know, move on into college and into higher education. Could you categorize the damage that these high school school systems are doing to higher education or by and large our society by sending kids with this concept of the country and the world into not only college but professional life?
Yeah, I think that what you end up having is I think American society to some extent has always been narcissistic. I mean, if you think about terms like manifest destiny and American exceptionalism, that's all part of what we get through formally through our education and formally through popular culture and so on. With high school, though, with these kinds of courses, what you end up with are students who might not be receptive to other points of view. We're not even talking about really points of view that are particularly, you know, leftist here or far left. We're talking about even centrist points of view where you at least get to ask the question, has Western civilization been a benefit to everyone around the globe, right? You can't even, in some cases, even asking that question is anathema to what most students, you know, by the time they get to higher ed want. And so you have a culture of folks who think of the U.S. as number one in everything, in all things, all the time, and in always a positive sort of manner. And the result is that one of three things can happen. Eventually that bubble gets busted, or that bubble stays there, in which case they make decisions for their lives on the basis of the fact that the U.S. is always going to be the way it's always been as far as they're concerned. Or a life, quite frankly, of sort of the disillusionment where things can't consistently go right in people's lives because people's lives are way more marbled than everything going right and everything going wrong. And so when things do go wrong, you make excuses on the basis of, well, it's because these other people have come to our shores and taken my jobs, or it's because, because this group of minorities took my position in education or got over on me, or it's because of these programs are meant to help vulnerable people. That's the problem when you have this sort of thinking, is that when you go through life, because life is not always about triumph after triumph, when you don't triumph, you have a tendency to blame others for your lack of ability to win all the time.
Right. Just for a final question, and this is for, you know, the folks on the app, and I'll warn you right now, this is a basic question, so feel free to wax poetic or just, you know, do what you do as a teacher of history in answering this. But what is lost in denying the basic contributions of the Eastern world in human progress as we know it today? What might not occur to, you know, John Q. Public out there about what they've contributed?
Well, Western civilization's ability to spread wouldn't have occurred at all. I mean, without those contributions, without the contribution of everything from printable, movable type from the Chinese, the compass, Arab numerals, which originally were Indian numerals, actually, everything from simple medical advances like quarantine systems so that, you know, an entire city's population doesn't die from bubonic plague, for instance, to long-range ocean-going vessels that were built by by people of South Asia, by Indians, or by Arab Muslims, or most notably the Ottoman Turks. Gunpowder, which was originally in China, cannons, which were built originally in China, perfected in India and Ottoman Turkey, and they made their way to Western Europe. All of those things enabled Europeans to sail the ocean blue, to go across the Atlantic, to circumnavigate the world, to find themselves in first contact with indigenous people in the Americas, to eventually exploit the resources and even people of those of Western Hemisphere, not to mention sail around the world and find all these areas for colonization. without all those contributions, Western civilization pretty much remains regional. It remains a regional development and stays regional. There's no way around the fact that without those contributions, without that base, Western civilization doesn't have the scientific revolution. Might not even have the Renaissance, but definitely not the scientific revolution, and certainly not the industrial revolution, which falls 100 years after the scientific revolution. So you absolutely need the contributions of the East. You absolutely need the contributions of the of Chinese astronomers and Indian mathematicians and Arab Muslim scholars and heck, African Muslim scholars in order for a lot of this stuff to have happened in the first place. So,
I know it's a very basic question, but when, you know, you have elected representatives, you know, talking about how other people's babies won't help us advance.
Right.
It's a world in which I think even the basic questions and answers need to be reiterated. But Donald, thank you so much for joining us on the Spearman app to talk about it.
Can I add one quick thing to your last?
Sure.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned that. The fact is, I don't think it's a basic question. I think when you have a system that is primarily about making people feel good about, not just about themselves, I mean, we should all feel good about themselves, and we should all feel good about our society, but we should also know our society. When you have a system that only wants to concentrate on sort of this civic nationalism, this idea that we're supposed to just feel good about a country and that's that, and not think through everything else, anything wrong, any injustices, any oppression, anything else. There's a tendency to forget. It makes basic questions not basic. That's the main point of all of this, is to create a population that quite frankly doesn't question in the final analysis anything that's going on around them, because it's just the way things are.
Right. In my very uneducated opinion, if I can wax even a little poetic here, I think that may require a new understanding through our entire society about what it means to have a positive self-image in light of honesty about one's own personal history. Not only bringing that philosophy, before you can bring that philosophy to, you know, a national perspective or a historical perspective, I think it needs to be done within the self. But, of course, we have a long way to even get there or integrate it into our education systems. But Donald, thanks so much again for joining us on the Spearman app to talk about this. It's endlessly fascinating stuff to me.
Thank you, Matthew. I appreciate the opportunity.